Hi, I'm Jean Prue, Spring Membership Drive Director. It's spring, a time when people are more active. WSCA is asking you to get radioactive during our Spring Seed the Power Membership Drive, going on May 3rd through May 9th. And during that time, please call 603-430-9722 or come in person to 909 Islington Street, Suite 1 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Or check us out online at www.wscafm.org and plant your seed to help WSCA continue to grow by giving whatever amount you can. Be sure to mark the date, May 3rd through May 9th, for our Seed the Power membership campaign.
And keep it tuned right here to 106.1 FM, WSCA LP, Portsmouth.
Sowing the seeds of love. Hey, this is Steve Carrigan, and you are on the program. You're listening to the program Local Folk here at WSCA. We have our spring drive coming up, and right before that was a piece by my guest, who I will announce in just a minute. I'm sure you're all wondering who that is. All righty. We heard something that was a bit like a song, a bit like sounds, a bit like all sorts of other things, and those were the work of Jason Krigler, who is my guest today. He is a sound, well, among many other things, he is doing not only the music, but the sound for a play that's coming up soon, and it's about soldiers that have had traumatic brain injuries. Jason, welcome to Local Folk.
Steve, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I am so glad you're here. What we were hearing, do you consider that a song, or was that just sound, or what was that?
That particular piece is part of a musical cue that is going to be in the play, which is called Make Sure It's Me. It's a play by Kate Wenner, and it's going to be put on here in Portsmouth at the Artists Collaborative Theater of New England. And the dates are going to be it's being put on in June. So,
okay.
But the play is it's a fascinating play, and it's about soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic brain injuries, and you really get a look at what these soldiers are going through, what their families have to go through, you know, the kind of stuff that these people have to overcome is monumental. And the effects of traumatic brain injury on all the soldiers from these wars, it's a really big issue. And it's really important that people become aware of what kind of hurdles are involved in this. Mm-hmm. So the play deals with that specifically, about these soldiers in Iraq coming home from Iraq, and it's a powerful play. And so I got involved. Leslie Pasternak is directing it. She actually just won 2 Seacoast Spotlight Awards recently, I think last week, for her work on a play last year called Clean Room. And she's really doing a great job with it. And Stephanie Voss Nugent is also producing it. So it's got some amazing actors in it. I can't say enough good things about it, but I feel really blessed to be involved in it, because it's dealing with an issue which is so important to today, the culture today. Like this is happening right now. These soldiers, I mean, traumatic brain injury is an issue that is out there now that people are dealing with, that people need to be more educated and understand more. So I'm really excited to be involved in this thing.
Is it so would you say that it's an educational play, or it's a dramatic play, or it's does a little bit of both?
It's definitely educational, but it's a play. I mean, there's a story, there's characters, and they have issues. And I believe the characters in the play, the author, the playwright Kate Wenner, based them on people that she had interviewed, actual soldiers who had returned. So, you know, there's definitely a story, and there's things going on with people that and relationships and that stuff. But it's extremely educational, because you really see very clearly what it's like for these soldiers coming home. And, you know, it's really heavy, you know, it's like, brain injury is no joke. You know, it's unbelievable the amount of damage it can do to you and the stuff you have to deal with. And, you know, I say this as somebody who's read the play, but I also say this as from my own personal experience, as the survivor of a brain injury. So I feel like I have a somewhat unique perspective on it from that angle as well. You know what I mean?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. See, I didn't say it right off the bat, but I wanted to talk about the play. But, you know, one of the things that you're noted for is your awesome recovery from a horrible brain injury.
Yeah.
You know, and this was, 9 years ago?
Yeah, coming up on 9 years. August 2004. I was living in New York City. I'm a guitarist. You know, I've been playing the guitar for 20-something years. And I was living in New York City and very busy as a working guitarist, playing with lots of different people. I was on stage one night in August of 2004, and all of a sudden I'm on stage, and all of a sudden the world just completely blows up. I start to see things that aren't there. My hearing is affected. Like the band, I'm on stage with a band, but they sound like they're, you know, 10 doors away or something, way down the hall. Like it's, my perception just gets completely freaky, and I have no way to explain. You know, I'm having this psychedelic experience that I have no explanation for, and I run off the stage finally because it's so, you know, I tell people, if it wasn't so scary, it would have been really cool, because
right.
I was seeing colors in the air, like bizarre stuff you can't explain. You don't know why it's happening. In the middle of the set that we're playing, this happens.
So did you
know?
Did you think you were dying? Or
I don't know.
I
thought maybe somebody spiked my drink or something with something that I didn't know. You know, right. I don't know what I thought. I was just freaked out. I ran off stage. Monica, my wife, was there. She was a couple months pregnant at the time. And I remember lying on the sidewalk outside the club, and I remember an ambulance coming, being put in the ambulance, and boom, that's the last thing I remember for a year and a half, was being put in that ambulance.
But you do remember that particular experience.
Yeah, I remember it happening very, very clearly.
See, now what's interesting.
So you know what it was I had a AVM, an arterial venous malformation. A collection of blood vessels in my brain got tangled and burst and caused intense bleeding, which led to more complications. The bleeding was so severe, my family was told that I probably wouldn't survive the night. And it just began this whole long journey of work and effort on my part and on my family's part to sort of overcome a lot of negative prognoses that were made about me, to sort of reclaim my life and to get back to my family and my life. It was definitely a turning point in my life, to say the least. So you can understand why a play like this, I feel a special passion for, and I feel really excited to be involved in it.
Well, I mean,
And I also have to say, like, I'm also very sensitive. Having been through this, I'm very sensitive to, like, if this play hadn't been this good, I wouldn't have wanted to do it. You know what I mean? Because I'm really sensitive to the whole issue of brain injury and recovery. So, like, when Leslie and Stephanie approached me, I was open to hearing about it, but part of me was a little like, I don't know, you know, I got to see this play. And then I read the play, and it's just, it's so beautiful how it's treated, how the subject matter is treated. This playwright, Kate Wenner, it's just really, really great how she presents this. These people are just real people, and their problems are real problems, and you can relate to it. So that made me want to be involved, you know. I would have had no problem saying pass if it didn't speak to me like that, but it did, and I'm glad to be doing it.
Well, it's coming up in June, and you've been chosen to compose the music for it. And not just the music, I'm sorry, you also told me that you had been, not just the music, but the sound. What did you
call
that?
Sound design.
The sound design.
Yeah, so sound design is a field in which, you know, whenever you see a film or a play or something, anytime there's a sound effect or a sound quality that's not a specific musical piece, not a specific piece of music, like a song or an orchestral piece or something. But if it's this a sound effect, you know, that's the sound design.
Well, I felt like I heard some bombs and, you know, definitely
exactly.
bombs and bullets and all that.
Yes, that those were in the piece that you heard there, and those were sound design elements.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the course of the play, there will be just sound design elements just on their own with no music behind them. But that particular piece has sound design elements mixed in.
Do you perform this when the play comes around? Are you going to be quote unquote performing this from a keyboard or a computer or something like that? Or
no, I'm recording it at my home studio and making it just right.
Okay,
and you know I'll work with when they get in the theater and working with the actors. I'll get the timing right and everything. But no, it's not meant to be played live. It's meant to exist in a recorded fashion. You can do things in the studio that. I guess technically it's conceivable it could be done live, but it would be a whole other animal to do that.
Well, I mean, they have to play some of it live, like track 3. Is that how it's going to
go? Yeah, exactly. It'll be that type of thing.
Okay.
It'll be that type of thing.
So I just want to back way up, if you don't mind, and just say, did you grow up with music?
I did, yeah. I grew up in a musical family. Both my parents are musicians. And
oh, both your parents are musicians?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Gigging musicians?
My dad is a professional musician and has been for many years. Pianist, composer, musical director for shows, you know. And my mom is a cellist and has worked professionally, but her main occupation, she's a teacher. But she has played professionally at various situations over the years as well. So there was always music in my family. You know?
Okay, so when you said, Mom, Dad, I want to be a musician, they weren't like, oh, gee, son. They were like, hey, you're part of the family.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't even know if I ever really said that, though. It's just, I started playing music, and that's just what I did most of the time, and it's what occupied me the most. And
did your parents, were they singing songs and playing music for you and saying,
no,
hey.
they come from the classical world, which, and my dad, you know, has a long history of doing shows as a musical director for shows. So, you know, I was always hearing classical music, you know, hearing him play like Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin, and, you know, my mom be practicing the cello. So it was always a class. They came from a classical background, so sort of different world.
You had it though, and so in your mind, people played music. It's one of the things that they did was that they practiced an instrument, and they it's part of your life,
right? Yeah, exactly.
And so you know, it was pretty normal to have that kind of thing going on in the house. It wasn't that you know, it wasn't like they didn't play, and you came home with a saxophone one day and said, "Mom, I'm going to learn this." Or
right,
whatever.
Right, right.
But how did that work? You didn't pick up a cello though. You know what?
No.
What was the first instrument that you played?
Drums.
Drums.
Yeah. In a New York City apartment.
And your parents came from a classical background, and you came home with drums.
Yeah, that's how cool my parents were. Are.
And they let you.
And they let me. They went for it. I don't even believe I got away with this. I had a full drum kit in our New York City apartment. I was banging away. I mean, I feel so bad for the neighbors. But back then, I was so young, I didn't even think about them. You know, it's like all I cared about was practicing. And, and then I got in bands, and I did this and that. And you know,
so it wasn't drums like bongos. This was a drum kit.
It was a full-on drum kit. I was pounding away. I was like
That's
14
awesome.
Years old. Yeah, ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, it was almost rebellious, you know, because a lot of classical musicians really have no taste for drums.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
Where did you get a taste for it? Just listening to regular music? Or
you know, I think it was because, you know, my dad would do these shows, these musicals, and a lot of times I would, you know, I would hear them night after night, and I think I just latched onto the drums. It just, in the context of an orchestra pit, a show pit, the drums just seemed so cool because they would be accenting things, and they would play in such a musical way in that context, in a way that it wasn't about being loud. It was about being tasteful, and it was about accenting key events that were happening on the stage and that kind of thing. So I just gravitated to the drums. I gravitated to the beat you know, the groove of them, you know, it just, it seemed like the thing to do.
Well, what's interesting is that you are almost full circle in what you're doing right now, because you're creating. So this whole idea of creating the sound, you know, for a play is not foreign to you. You know, it's something that you grew up with.
Yeah, right. Well, it's always been about accompaniment. Always for me, music has been. I mean, it's always been about accompaniment. When I was in New York, working as a sideman, as a guitarist, it was about accompaniment. I would be accompanying singers, and I would want to find, that's the thing that excites me the most about music, you know, is how do you play the right thing to make the singer sound better than they are? How do you find the right sonic place to sit in that makes the singer sound amazing? How do you find the right music to complement this play, make sure it's me, the right sounds, the right sounds at the right time, to bring out what's already there to make it even more three-dimensional, more alive. You know, that's the thing that I get excited about. So, and it's always been that way, whether it's been drums or guitar or composing or, you know, whatever. It's always about accompaniment to me.
So you always saw yourself as the enhancer, basically.
The enhancer, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which isn't to say, you know, I mean, when I play in my band, which doesn't happen a lot these days, but you know, I like to sort of stretch out on the songs, and you know, there's some when it's time to have guitar solos, I'm all for them and I love them when it's appropriate and good, but it has to be right and it has to be the right moment and that kind of thing.
So you try to keep it kind of low key, or so to speak, would you say? Or
yeah, I just
depending
like
on
to,
the situation.
I like to take whatever's there and make it better.
And make it better.
That's
yeah.
what I like to do. If I can.
If you can. Can you make things that don't sound good sound better?
Sometimes, yeah.
That's
can.
Always a good thing.
Yeah, sometimes you really can. And sometimes it's really tough yeah. to do it, you know. I mean, I feel like my time in New York was amazing, because my time playing in New York,
yep.
which was like 98 to 2004, when I was really active playing downtown in New York, was great, because I was in so many different situations playing with so many different people, and you just learn, you learn by doing. That's the best way to learn. And I played with so many people, and I was in situations where I would just come home and I would be just completely depressed and like, what am I doing? This is ridiculous. I'm a failure, blah, blah, blah. And then the next night I'd have some situation and I'd come home and I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is the most amazing thing. I mean, I was a part of this amazing thing. So it's like, it was a real roller coaster emotionally of like different situations. And that's great, because you yeah. learn from that. You know, that's the best way to learn, yeah. really.
Oh, it sure is. Well, I mean, did you cross, how many different genres did you cross?
Oh, there were a ton. I mean, I was really, my sort of home base in New York was songwriters. So I would accompany other songwriters. That was sort of my home base. But from that, other things would sort of blossom from that. Like, I played in this group, Pharaoh's Daughter, for a few gigs, and they did all this Middle Eastern music with these different time signatures and stuff. You know, that
cool.
was really off the
super cool
thing. And then, you know, I played in a group called Edison Woods, and they were doing this really sort of slow, ethereal, you know, trance kind of slow core type of vibe. You know, there were all these things, these offshoots that would happen, you know, and New York City is great for that, because there's a million things going on at any time, you know.
Yeah.
So it's great. It was great.
That's super cool. Hey, I'd love to play a little bit of music, and then I think we'll have to do something with the community calendar and this and that. But I have a CD that I have in the CD player that I could play from, that I want to talk about how that whole thing happened.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Or I don't know if you have something else, but yeah, why don't we play it? Why don't we play a track from this?
Yeah,
CD
play a track
right
from
here,
this. What would be good? Why don't you start with track number 3?
The Bush and the Tree song, part
yeah,
one?
Yeah, this song is sort of a staple. Whenever I do a show, I always play this song. This isn't me singing. This is a great, great singer named Amy Correa, but I play guitar on this. I produced it. She sings it, but I'm all over the guitar and the arrangements, and it's one of the sort of, I mean, I love this whole record, but I think she really nails it on this. And I can talk about the record after you play it and explain the whole.
Excellent. Yeah, well, we're going to listen to this, the Bush and the Tree song, part one, and then I'm going to come back with an announcement, and then we'll be right back into the interview, right here on Local Folk.
I'm hiding in the bush and it won't fit you. I'm hiding in the bush and it won't fit you. Oh, no, what can I do? Hiding in the bush and it won't fit you. Bush is no good, what can I do? Go find a tree to climb into. Oh no, what can I do? I found a tree but it won't fit you. I'm feeling real good cause I'm way up high. Way between the earth and the sky. Feeling real good cause I'm way up high. Couldn't find me if you tried. Don't know how I find the way to stay.
I'm Deb, a longtime WSCA listener and member. It's springtime when people are more active. WSCA is asking you to get radio active during the Spring Seed the Power membership drive going on May 3rd to May 9th. During that time, please call 603-430-9722. Come in person to 909 Islington Street, Suite 1 in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, or go online at wscafm.org. And plant your seed to help WSCA continue to grow by giving whatever amount you can. Be sure to mark the date, May 3rd to May 9th, for the WSCA Seed the Power membership campaign. I'm happy to be a member of WSCALP Portsmouth.
Hey, welcome back to Local Folk. My name's Steve Kerrigan, and I'm here with Jason Krigler. Hey, I need to let you know that programming on Portsmouth Community Radio is made possible by you, our members, and by The Press Room, featuring live blues, jazz, folk, R&B, Latin jazz, and more, Monday through Sunday, along with appetizers, sandwiches, and entrees at 77 Daniel Street. Schedules at pressroomnh.com. Now, Jason, this album, this song that we just listened to, by the way, that sounded awesome.
Well, I would hope so. That record took 9 years, so it better sound good. I mean, good gosh.
9 years. So this is, Yeah, I told you earlier that my wife suffered a stroke just a few years ago, and it's been, 3 years now, and she started an album before she had the stroke.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, and she was, actually, I had her as a guest on the show, and we played some of the beginning, you know, stuff that she had done.
That's great.
And someday, you know, we're going to finish this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you've done just that. You started an album before this whole baloney happened.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing. Like, I was in New York City. I was playing with all these amazing singers, and I had it in my head, like, you see these records that come out every now and then, like all these artists do the music of the Beatles, or they all do the music of the Eagles, or whatever it is. I was like, I want everyone to do my music, but I knew all these great singers. I was like, I'm just going to get all these people to sing, and it's going to be my own... a tribute record to myself.
Was that the original intent?
No. I recorded these tracks. I recorded the basic tracks, meaning the foundation tracks, the drums, the bass, the original guitars, thinking it would be a record that I would put out. And then I got this idea, and then I started asking people to come over and sing. And that track that you played, Amy Correa, that was one of the first ones, if not maybe the first. It might have been the first one. She and I lived on the same block in Brooklyn, and I knew her, and I just knew she would sound great singing that song. So I invited her over, and, you know, she came up. She'd never heard it. I mean, I think we were done in 15 minutes. She just sang it, and that's what it was, you know, and it's she just has the right vibe. And so this record became a thing about, like, I wanted to really find the right voice for every song, and the songs are a little bit eclectic, and I needed to – so but then what happened was my injury happened right in the middle of doing it, and – you know, a year and a half goes by, and when I started to pick up the guitar again, it was really difficult. Like, I was having a lot of trouble playing the guitar at first, but I just physically, it was hard to do. But this record was still on my computer, and so I started calling people and started working on it again, and it was like this great musical activity that I was invested in that I cared about, and it wound up being a help in my recovery to have this thing to focus on again, because I could call people up, ask them to do things, and because of what had happened to me, everybody would drop everything to help me, which was another little great thing. So it actually got done, and there's just some great, great moments on it. I'm really proud of it.
Well, it's called the Music of Jason Krigler, and is this you on the front there? It looks just like you.
That's me, yeah, okay. With a sort of crazy cover of me emerging from some... I think it's sort of a metaphor for what I had been through.
Yeah.
But,
like a superhero, as they say.
Something, yeah. Just emerging from the rubble of destruction or something.
So you chose to focus on this in order to help your recovery, or you're just like, I don't even know what I want to do. I mean, where was your head at when you said, you know, this is something that that I'm going to start to work on again?
I just knew I had started it because I just thought it was a great idea, and I'd had some early success. Like, that song with Amy was one of the first ones, and then I did another one with Teddy Thompson sings one, and both of those, Teddy and Amy's songs, just sounded so perfect that I was just like, I have to see this through.
Yeah.
And I got really passionate about it. Like, and then my injury happened in August of 2004, and I know I recorded a couple people earlier that summer, and it came out great.
Well,
I was already really invested in it
and
everything.
So you said, so after this whole thing happened, to let people know, you don't remember like a year of your life.
A year and a half is gone from my memory, yeah. From the night it happened to a year and a half after that.
So what you remember, I mean, what, when you realized that,
yeah, it's
was it
weird.
Just horrible, or was
it's strange because you got to imagine, like, I was so physically compromised. I was, you know, completely thin and frail. I had real difficulty walking. You know, I was in a wheelchair for a long time. I was just, and my brain was just working so hard to recover basic functioning that I wasn't retaining any short term memory. So, you know, it's not like all of a sudden one day things flipped on again. It was this hazy, very gradual reemergence of memory and awareness. And, you know, I was home. I was an inpatient in four different hospitals for a year and a week solid. And then I came home, and then, you know, for 6 months I was home. I wasn't retaining memory. And it's just, I gradually started to become aware of what had happened, become aware that I was a father now, become aware that I had all these physical issues I had to deal with. So it was like a very gradual, painstaking, a lot of drudge work, you know, daily toil.
Does it bug you to this day that there's this extra work?
You know, I have moments where it does, but, you know, I think, I mean, it's been a lot of years now. I've really sort of worked hard to train myself to focus on the good things that have come out of it. Yeah. You know, I think that's the only way I can move forward in my life is to have my attitude be as good as it can be, because I can't change the past. There's nothing I could have done to prevent this. They don't know why it happened, but I was in great shape. I took care of myself. I was young. No reason it, but it did. So I have to deal with it. I can't sit around. I have moments, yeah, where, but only moments, they pass, you know.
Yeah. Well, what do you think was the main element of you? I mean, just so people are aware, we're talking as, and you know, you're speaking with me, and people say this to my wife too. They find it hard to, they would say, I can't tell that you even had a stroke.
Yeah, well, you can go and see very clearly what I was like, because there's footage that exists.
There was a whole documentary.
There was a whole documentary made called Life Support Music about my whole recovery and about my family and what they went through and what they did to help me. And it's called Life Support Music. You know, you can go online and see trailers and order the film, and it's out there. It was on PBS. So what
you're doing right now, just even talking to me, is miraculous.
Yeah, in the opinion of a bunch of the doctors that we encountered, this should not be happening.
This should not be happening.
Right,
at all.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
but it's cool. It's like my yeah. my story is a one tiny sliver of a piece in helping to change the way people see what's possible in terms of recovery from an injury like this. I mean, that's a cool thing.
That is cool. That is super cool.
I like being a part of something like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you came from way behind.
Oh, yeah. The doctors told my family the first night the bleeding was so severe that it was really unlikely I would live. And if I did live, I would probably need round-the-clock care, and I'd always have to be in assisted living of some sort or whatever. And
so how'd you get better? I mean, just in a sentence or something like that, was it willpower? Was it...
There was a doctor in New York, Dr. Narayan, who early on really, he was one of the very few people, maybe even the only person at that time in the medical world who thought that I would recover.
Okay.
And we love him, and my family loved him then. And I asked him years later, how did he know that early on? And he was like, three things. He said, first of all, my age, that I was young when it happened.
Okay. Yeah.
Second of all, my work ethic. Like, he saw in me that I was very, very persistent and worked very hard at my exercises and recovering and all that stuff. And the third factor, he said, was my family. My family was so involved in my care and so on top of helping me and advocating for me. And it made a huge, huge difference. And in fact, that's what the documentary, that's really the slant that the documentary shows, is how much my family put into it. And it made a big difference.
And your family, your wife?
My wife, Monica, and my parents, and who are divorced, but, you know, and my sister, Marjorie, that was sort of the core element. And then there was Monica's family as well, were helpful too. But those were the core people that were sort of always, one of them was always sort of around me.
Well, if people want to get a hold of this, you can go to jasonkriglermusic.com.
Yeah.
And there's something that says documentary on there, and you
yeah,
can click
it
on
does.
It and they'll bring
right.
people on it, and
that's right.
they can watch this, you
yeah.
know. And now you're out helping other people. I want to also talk about this. I want to get back to the music for a minute. I just wanted the people that maybe listening to know that I mean, I have conversations with people every single week, but where you came from to get to the point of just chatting with me.
Yeah.
I mean, chatting with you, it's no big deal, you know? I mean, it's
We wouldn't be doing this 6 years ago or 7 years ago.
No, but we're doing it now.
We're doing it now. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's cool.
I want to play a composition called Gate Circle, at least a piece of it anyways.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So this is
something I composed for a film. This is a lot of what I'm doing now. You know, I've got a studio at my home, and I just, it's great. I go up there and I compose music for film and ads and other media forms and installation pieces and blah, blah, blah. But it's great. I've really been working hard at developing this sort of side of myself, and I really like how this piece came out.
Let's give this a listen. This is Steve Kerrigan. You're listening to Local Folk, and I'm with Jason Krigler. And what we just played was part of what his profession is right now, which is as a composer and a sound designer. That was done on a keyboard, was it? Or
I don't know. Maybe, perhaps. I mean, I have all kinds of ways of making sounds, you know, and I've got... You know, we could have a much longer discussion about it, but
I would love to get into how this whole thing happened,
we'll have
because
to
you're
do
actually
another,
a multifaceted instrumentalist, really. I mean, you were mostly playing guitar, I think, when all this stuff went down in New York City, but you were playing drums, and obviously it sounds like there's lots of other ways that you think of music in a really broad sense.
I try to, you know.
Let's talk about what's going on tomorrow, what's coming up.
Yeah, so I wanted to let people know that this play that we talked about in the beginning, which is called Make Sure It's Me, which is happening in June in Portsmouth, they're doing these, like, they've been making the rounds, by the director, Leslie Pasternak, and various members of the cast, and also various veterans, service members, and family members have been making the rounds at libraries around the seacoast, and there's going to be another one of these events tomorrow at the Lane Memorial Library in Hampton. It's 6:30 p.m. and I'm definitely going to go to this one and be at this one, and I've been wanting to make these and it just hasn't worked, and I'm determined. There's always been something. It's either been a snowstorm or a snow day or something or other, and tomorrow I'm going to be there. Determined to be there, so it should be really cool. So if people want to come check it out, find out more about the play, you know, hear some thoughts about it, hear a little bit of reading, discussion, it should be really cool. It's at the Lane Memorial Library in Hampton.
So they're going to do a little bit of a reading about it?
I don't even know exactly the details of how they do it, but I think it's that type of thing, and then there's a discussion, and that's...
So they're going around to the libraries to talk about this play.
To talk about the play and to talk about the issues. In the play, which is, you know, traumatic brain injury and how do we deal with this really important issue today, you know?
I mean, these soldiers are going off and getting legs blown off, arms, I mean, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And also their brains are getting, you know, joggled up and messed
right.
up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's,
exactly.
It's bad news.
It's bad news. Yeah, it really is. It really is. So it's great that this play is out there and it's got such a great team behind it. And, you know, I'm excited to be a part of it.
Because the thing is with a brain injury is that my experience with brain injury is that it's a little bit insidious, you know, where like sometimes, you know, you can see what's going on. Sometimes you can't see what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
well, the tricky thing about it is that everybody's different. Every brain injury is different. And
yeah.
So, you know, what's true for one person is not necessarily true for somebody else. And so, you know, there were so many times people would say I wouldn't do this or wouldn't do that but then I would do those things, and it's really hard to get answers because the brain is sort of, there's so much that's unknown still.
So much.
But that being said, the medical world is very slow to embrace change, and you know, there are incredible developments in neuroplasticity and what we now know about the brain's ability to heal itself, and the time frame involved for the brain to heal is much longer than was thought of, you know. So there are new things being developed all the time, and the medical world is slow to embrace those new things, but you know, they're happening. It's out there.
I mean, they told my wife, you know, you'd be 95% of whatever was going to happen was going to happen in a short period of time.
Yeah, the window of opportunity.
Yeah.
They love to make these they love to give bad news. It's really a drag, you know, because I shouldn't say they love to do it, but they're used to doing it, or it's sort of the fallback way of coping with it from the medical world. It's like they think they have to give you the worst case scenario, and that's why my sister and I are out there talking, because we're sort of like, okay, we're going to balance it out a little. We're talking about here's a good something that turned out pretty well, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So.
Well, the medical community does crazy things. You know, I have my wife in the hospital with a brain injury, and they're saying, do you want Advil or Ativan? Advil or Ativan? And
right.
She's like, blah, I don't know.
Yeah.
They're two very different things.
Well, that's why, you know, it's so important to have somebody there who can advocate for you, you know? It's really important.
Yeah, that particular case was pretty upsetting, actually, because I think they just wanted to give her something to calm down. But you really, you know, anyways, yeah, you do need somebody there because, you know, how can you?
Yeah, exactly.
How can you just do that yourself? You can't.
Right.
You can't. DefyingTheOdds.net.
Yeah.
What is that exactly? Is that the...
That's the website of the project, my sister and I. So what happened was, you know, after my injury, this filmmaker who I had known from before, we sort of invited him in, and he made this incredible documentary film called Life Support Music. It won a bunch of awards at film festivals. It was shown on PBS across the whole country. Because of that, I started getting invited to speak at places. People said, well, do you want to come speak? Brain injury associations at first. And so I was like, okay, I'm into this, but if I'm going to do this, I got to figure it out. So my sister Marjorie and I, Marjorie was really involved in my care throughout the whole thing. And we put together this program, and we run like a PowerPoint presentation where we sort of talk about what happened, how it happened, you know. And so DefyingTheOdds.net, that website, is the website of our presentation that we do. And you can see a little trailer, and you can see where we've done it and read a little blurb about it. But it's basically, you know, it's been 4+ years of us doing this. We now have a couple speakers bureaus that are booking us, and we've been, you know, we've done very little outreach ourselves. It's like, I would say 90% is stuff that's come to us, just word of mouth. But it's amazing because the audience, it's an incredible story. It applies to so many different venues and circumstances and groups, because it's a story about overcoming unbelievable odds, about family pulling together. It's really a great thing for me. I'm somebody, I never would have, in a million years, I would have dreamed of being a public speaker. That never would have crossed my mind. But I love being a part of this because it's a tiny sliver of doing something really good in this world. And it feels really great to do that. You know what I mean? So we just went down to Maryland last week to the Brain Injury Association there. We're going to Wisconsin this week. And we got more. So it's like, it just keeps going on. It's exciting.
That's excellent. So you're doing music, you're a public speaker.
Right. I know. It's crazy, right? I got to just next. I don't know what I'll do next. Tap dancing, maybe.
I don't know what. Hey, that sounds like a good one. Next thing you know, you'll be teaching. You'll be a tap dance teacher too.
There you go. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, JasonKrieglerMusic.com. Defying that's your music site,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
DefyingTheOdds .net is your tour with your sister that
yeah,
you're doing.
That's
information
right.
about that.
That's right.
In the name of the documentary, you can go to that, and that's a
life
website
support
as well.
Music.
Life support music. It's life period support period.
Yeah, right.
Life support music.
Yeah,
I like the way that was. Okay, so all of those things, and also this play that you're doing, and there's something at the Hampton Public Library, and that is happening tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 6:30, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you want to find out more information just about brain injury, about this play that's happening, about all of that, you can go down to the Hampton Public Library tomorrow, and that is at what time, just one more time?
It's at 6:30 at the Hampton Library, and the play is called Make Sure It's Me, and it's going to be showing at the West End Studio Theater in Portsmouth starting in June. Bunch of dates in June. So that's the story.
And the one other thing that I want to do is I got to get going because we've got Under the Radar coming up next, but I just want to play one more song to leave our audience with. And this is one that's sung by you?
Sung by me, yeah. This is called The Books on the Shelf. And this is the first song that I wrote after the, you know, a year and a half, I don't remember, and recovering. And it was really difficult to think about writing a song at this time because I was just really compromised physically and had no self-confidence whatsoever that I, even though I'd written a ton of songs, I it had been a couple years almost. And I just, this song was the song in which I wrote in which I was able to sort of show myself that I still am able to do this. So it's sort of an important song for me. And we'll just end with that. It's a good ender, good closer.
Thanks, Jason. You know? Thanks for being on Local Folk.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
Okay.
And all right.
Thanks for you listeners as well, and we will see you next week.
The books on the shelf, some straight up and down, blankets of dust, finger but left untouched, finger but left untouched. Picturing positives, just the opposite of carrying stones to church, carrying stones to church. I lost my voice in the forest, I fell down on my knees, tried to make a sound, my body on a tightrope made of light. unraveling pages. The poem I wrote. Stuff's in the cracks and laughs. Stuff's in the cracks and laughs. Stuff's in the cracks. Thank you, guys.